Hello all, and welcome to the Book Spider podcast. Book Spider is a Book of the Week podcast in which we agonize over the small things, such as protracted several-page scenes in which a husband and wife silently vacillate between love and resentment for one another. My name is Chris Malmberg, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Patrick Barney and Hans Berger. We're here to discuss Virginia Woolf's 1927 novel, To the Lighthouse. To the Lighthouse is broken up into three parts spanning 10 years. We begin in 1910 with Part 1, The Window, following the Ramsey family at a vacation home on the Isle of Skye. Mr. and Mrs. Ramsey and their children are joined by several acquaintances, including Lily Briscoe, a young woman artist. By every measure, the plot of Part 1 is extraordinarily minor domestic tension. One central conflict literally concerns opinions about the weather of the following day and how likely it will be that the party will be able to make it out to the eponymous lighthouse, which is across a body of water. Another minor conflict arises when a guest asks for a second helping of soup. This is literally, basically, the foundation of the conflict in most of this novel. Very domestic, very mannered. But really, the story is in the titanic shifts in feeling that take place in the characters' bodies and minds. Mrs. Ramsey wanders between adoration and resentment for her husband, sometimes within the space of a few sentences. Mr. Ramsey is sure of himself one moment and falling apart the next. If the characters take very little consequential action, their minds nonetheless traverse huge dreamlike planes full of flickering convictions, compulsions, and doubts. In Part 2, Time Passes, we jump out of the heads of the characters into a higher plane of omniscience. We see 10 years go by, Mrs. Ramsey and a couple Ramsey children die, and the vacation home deteriorates over the years. The novel closes with Part 3, The Lighthouse, where we return to the close omniscient cartography of the inner lives of the surviving Ramseys and their friends. They've returned to the vacation home in 1920, with Mr. Ramsey dragging his children on the trip to the lighthouse that they didn't take 10 years prior. Here again, very little of consequence actually happens, but we do see James reach a state of grace with his father and Lily with her art. So we've talked about a few novels that we liked better at a line level than at a narrative arc or character study or plot level. I think like Lookout Cartridge, there's been a few of them that have cropped up over the past year. I don't really think of To the Lighthouse quite like those, even though I'd say that the story is sort of boring. And I kind of came to the end of it and I couldn't say I had a super holistic grasp of the characters because their internal complexities are so, I don't know, either finely wrought or complicated that I can't really say that I have a very, very clean grasp of each of them at the end of the novel. There is something at the line level in how I sort of read and experience this novel and the way that we seem to flit so freely between the POVs of the characters and their deep headspaces that I really do enjoy, though. And I guess I'm saying that the strength of this novel is in experiencing it at the line level, even if the lines of themselves don't jump out, at least for me. And I'm just sort of wondering if you guys sort of agree with me that like this, there's something about the experience of reading this novel that's compelling. And if you could help me describe what that is, because it is, I think, in my experience, sort of singular how Woolf is sort of doing something here with her close attention to the internal, the inner spaces of these characters and how she sort of jumps between them in this way that feels almost very intuitive and not necessarily hard to follow, but because it's so intuitive, maybe hard to assemble after the fact. So there's an experience that is very, very enjoyable for me of reading this and sort of being close to these characters and jumping between them and their own feelings jumping all over the place, very intuitively. that at the end, I feel like I've really enjoyed it, but I also feel a little bit distanced from it. And maybe you could help me out, like talking about what Virginia Woolf is doing here and whether or not you enjoyed it like I did.
Well, I think that almost all descriptions of human subjectivity are in some sense kind of like zoomed out, right? Like you are getting the flow of somebody's thoughts at a level that is not really accurate to the granularity of what they're feeling minute to minute, right? Everything that you, your sense of human subjectivity is kind of, it's reduced for the sake of a novel, because even though it's theoretically a representative art, I think it's one where you kind of have to, it's like motion smoothing in a television, right? Like you have to kind of, you're looking at everything from a 30,000 foot view. And I think you don't really understand that until you read a novel like this. I mean, it seems like the goal here, as far as I can articulate it, the goal here is to capture the granularity of instant-to-instant human thought and feeling in a way that no other fiction really had up to that point, right? You know, Woolf kind of famously, in the writing of this novel, sat around and just, like, tried to track her own thoughts in a quiet moment. And so, I mean, I think what she's doing here is presenting us a granular view that makes us aware of how we're normally used to a 10,000 foot view that we don't even think about. It's 10,000 footness, right? It's, and I think that there's something very disorienting about that, because we're used to the nature of fiction being that even a great level of ambivalence in a character is kind of distilled and simplified into something that is simpler than how one feels minute to minute in the real world. There's a, I can't remember, I might be mangling this, right? But like the human body is never the same temperature, right? Like there are constantly little fluctuations in your temperature, and your quote unquote temperature is kind of like the average of all these little ups and downs, right? Like, and this is kind of metaphorically the same as that, right? Like Mrs. Ramsey's feeling for Mr. Ramsey is an average of all these second to second oscillations. And I mean, I think that that's an accurate rendering of how some human relationships are, if not every, right? Like, I mean, I don't think I've ever been involved with somebody romantically that I didn't have, like, you know, pretty significant shifts of you know, fondness, irritation. You kind of simplify it into, you know, oh, I love you. But there's all these little kind of minute-to-minute particularities. You know, you see somebody in one light and you think, oh, gosh, you're gorgeous. And you see them from a slightly different angle and light and you think, oh, you're all right, I guess. And you never really reconcile all those in your mind. And so, I mean, that, I think the way that she's, I don't think that you can capture that thing, right? I don't think that you can summarize that part of how human thought flows in a way that has a conventionally interesting plot. I mean, that might be a little bit peripheral to your question. I think part of your question was, is it enjoyable, right? And it is, for sure. I don't think that I've ever read this book with the level of focus and concentration that it probably demands.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you guys feel like you did, but I mean, I've read this book three times, and in all three cases, it's been either for this podcast or, you know, a school-related reason. And there's, you know, it's something where you always have to finish it in a particular length of time. And inevitably, there are ideas that, like, I'll every now and again, I'll think, boy, I've really kind of been skimming, and I'll, like, go back through a paragraph, and I'll think, oh, that's a really fantastic little thought. But I think it's one of those books that it's probably almost impossible to feel like you've gotten the fullness of, really, unless you are, you know, going at it over and over again in a really scholarly way.
I'm not even sure that that would pay off if you were trying to assemble a complete understanding. Like, it seems like part of what you're talking about is that to kind of honestly get at this moment to moment dynamic truth, this more sort of higher resolution experience of a human mind, that they don't necessarily need to assemble into some, you know, greater meaning in order to, it's not the goal is not that they, the point is not that they assemble into a greater meaning. The point is that they shift, and they're shifting constantly. And there's a weather in our heads that, pushes thoughts all over the place. And even kind of the things that the stories that we tell us ourselves about who we are, not even just the stories that we tell each other about each other, but the story that we tell ourselves about ourselves kind of tries to sort of even that out. Like, we don't really confront how fast our thoughts sort of jump all over the place. So I don't know that, you know, like, I guess you could read it to and really pay attention to all the tiny moments to just appreciate them more directly and appreciate what she's doing. But I don't know that coming to the end of this with a really with a holistic understanding of the whole thing would really be getting there.
I think it would be less about a holistic understanding of the whole thing and just more a sense that I hadn't missed any good paragraphs. There might be a page length paragraph with a really interesting thought in it that you really have to dig at. You really have to pay attention to. You really have to stick with to really kind of extract in reading. And so I can imagine getting to the end of it and feeling like I hadn't skimmed anything, but it would take a long time and it would just be deeply antithetical to the way that all our attention spans are set up at this point in history, right? It's like,
yeah,
it could be an infinite book, essentially. This book could be 1,000 pages long and it wouldn't really have any more or less of a conventional plot than if it were 200 pages long. You could take this material, I think, and maybe I'm wrong about this, maybe you guys can challenge this assertion if you want, but I think that you could add an immense amount of this same sort of stuff and not really get something that was any more, it'd be like more oatmeal, you know? I don't mean that in a bad way, but like...
Do we all know how you love oatmeal? It's one of your favorites.
Well, you can have a bowl of oatmeal or a swimming pool full of oatmeal, and it's all just oatmeal, right?
Okay. Yeah, it's true.
I don't know if I made the point that I wanted to there. My point, I guess, was just that you could extend this a great distance in both directions and not give us any more of a conventionally appealing plot, not give us any more of the kinds of things most people come to novels for. So in some sense, it's like with most novels, you know, there's, and maybe you guys don't do this, but I think with most novels, there's some parts you read quickly, there are other parts you read slowly, like yeah. your speed of reading, your level of attention fluctuates a bit depending on, is this a key moment? Is this an important bit of reflection? Is this dialogue, right? And it's like with this book, any given moment is pretty much undifferentiated from any other moment as far as the level of attention that it would require. And that's, there's something kind of alien about that, particularly in something that's, you know, good, right? I think you yeah. had mentioned in our discussion that there are certain novels that are bad for young readers to emulate and, you know, spoiler for that question, I guess, but I would agree that this is one of them.
And I kind of want to jump to that, but I'm curious, Patrick, what do you think about like the experience of To the Lighthouse? And do you agree with Hans that there's not necessarily like any need for there to be an underlying... It sounds kind of like Hans, what you're saying is there doesn't need to be a vessel, a plot vessel or narrative arc vessel to kind of contain this, the experience of this novel, because the novel's purpose is sort of in this super close scrutiny of human minds, and that's really the pleasure in reading it, and that can kind of go on infinitely in every direction. What do you think?
To be clear, I know this. I know it's Patrick's turn, but just to clarify, I mean, I do think that like the characters here do to some extent exist as characters, right? Like, I mean, you know, they do have you could draw up a profile of them, I think, in the way that you would draw up a profile of any other character. The profile would, you know, account for all the little, what you called the weather in their head. Anyway, sorry, go ahead, Patrick.
Well, okay. So, like, there's a couple layers here. So, do I think this is successful at, like, really examining the, or getting to the granularity of the human mind? I'm not sure. Like, when I think about books that really try to get to the granularity of the human mind, I'm drawn to really books that are kind of free written, so to speak. This guy doesn't get mentioned that much in creative writing circles, but Henry Miller, you know, even though he is detestable in a lot of ways, does this kind of free-written, crazy, like, off the top of your head, just rapid-fire stream of consciousness stuff really well. Like, he writes a lot of compelling line-level stuff from that perspective. And to my mind, if we're actually thinking about, like, the granularity of the human mind, it's going to be closer to, like, that Henry Miller-esque thing where, like, it's mostly incoherent. It mostly doesn't make any sense. It's mostly, like, interesting images and sounds, but, like, it's not going to be deeply coherent. And so when we look at this book, I would say, like, obviously on a narrative arc level, this is not like a coherent book. It doesn't have like these plot threads that go through anywhere or do anything. You're really just kind of looking at these different people's thoughts. And if we're really going to look at the granularity of people's thoughts, I don't think they're actually going to be this neat. With, like, it's not hard. Like when you're following along Mrs. Ramsey and she's like, man, too many people, you know, are cutting the skins off of vegetables. Like, what are you doing? It, like, the skins are good. They taste, they're nutritious, and they make it taste good. Why would you do that? Like, that's awesome. That's an awesome thought. But, like, if you were actually looking at somebody's mind, would you really be able to follow any of their thoughts? I'm less optimistic that you would be able to follow the mental processes of another person as well as you do in some of these areas. That said, obviously there's a lot to enjoy about this novel. Like the aforementioned, like, cutting the skins off of tubers was actually one of my favorite parts. Like, I really enjoyed that, like, idea. Now, if we're talking, like, is this a novel that is successful at, like, saying how it thinks fiction should be written, I would say it's more successful in that, in that, like, it kind of meanders between characters without much differentiation, like Han said, like, in part two, it draws back and, like, examines this huge space of time, 10 years of time, and then it zooms back in, so it's kind of like a lens is zooming in and out. So on that level, I think that it's successful at saying, like, here are some fiction techniques that are really cool, so let's use them. I think fiction should be done this way. Yeah, that's my overall reaction, I think.
I like that you found the word that I think is useful, coherence. And
right.
Even though you said that you feel that, like, the level of coherence here actually exceeds what we would experience if we were to dive this deep into right. the minds of people right, and right. really pay attention to it. I think that might be true. I think, you know, that kind of brings me sort of out of order to another question that I had about sort of true representation. Mm. You know, Wolf coined the phrase the white light of truth in her essay Room of One's Own, and she uses that to kind of distinguish between authorial style and how many styles are sort of casting light upon their subjects to and washing their subjects in unobjective light. So, like, if you she uses the term red light of emotion, and if you cast red light on stuff, it's all going to look red. And so the white light of truth is sort of a metaphor for style that is trying to cast things in an even light and get a fair representation of them. And I think, you know, Patrick, I think that we circle around these subjects a lot, you know, in these podcasts right. where, like the purpose of storytelling and how close it can actually come to authentically representing the world. And in my opinion, you know, fiction is a lie that gets at a truth. Mm. And so I think, like, I like going back to that word that you used, coherence, because it's a word that should have occurred to me when I was typing up my questions and the summary, because it really accurately reflects the struggle that I have with this book after I've read it. Like, the coherence does sort of escape me. It's not really something that coheres, but the experience of it feels like it's authentically getting at that liquid, mercurial, like, inner nature that these characters have, that we all have. And so I guess the question that I want to circle back to, and it sounds like, Patrick, you believe that it doesn't really get at truth. It doesn't quite get there. But my question is about that. Like, is this getting at something that is true? And, you know, what is that truth that is being captured here?
Just to kind of reiterate what I said as a response, like, if Wolf, and this is where I think, like, authorial intent is kind of important to know, and, like, obviously we can't really know it, but, like, to answer this question, we need to know what Wolf is trying to do. Is she, in fact, trying to accurately represent how human minds function, like, on a linguistic level? Like, if you were to go into somebody's mind and you heard what they were thinking, is this what it would be like? And if that is what she's trying to do, I would say no, this is not what it would be like. If you were to just drop into somebody else's mind, there would be less context, less available context, and you would not really know what the F is going on. Which isn't to say that there's not some other truth that Wolf is going for that like could be accurately represented.
I mean, it doesn't really seem to me like, and maybe the thing I'm about to say undermines the possibility of this novel succeeding or even, like, really existing, but if you were to drop into somebody's head, like, people's thoughts are not actually a sequence of words, are they? Like, while you were talking just now, one of our cats was climbing all over me and yowling and flopping its butt against me, and I was, even though it was cute, I was pretty annoyed by it because it was, like, not the time and place, right? And if you were to drop in my head, you wouldn't have had a sequence of words about, you wouldn't have had a sequence of words to the effect of, stupid cat, fucking cat, I hate this cat. I love you, cat. Oh, I hate you, cat. Right. Oh, cat's right. Pouring, cat's flopping, right? Like, it's much less coate than that. And so,
right.
I mean, if the question is, does this represent what it would be like if you were literally dropped into a person's head, I think that that is not something that the form of the novel is able to do, and it's not something Henry Miller could do any sooner than Virginia Woolf could. I mean, so inevitably, you know, what
sure.
Woolf and Miller would both be doing is trying to take that and translate it into another medium. So the question is really just whose translation feels more authentic. Now, I have read Tropic of Cancer and Tropic of Cancer, God damn it, Capricorn? Is that right?
The
Cancer
Tropics.
And Capricorn, the two tropics.
Cancer and Capricorn, yeah.
Yeah, I've read both of them, and I honestly just completely bounced off them.
Right.
I mean, it wasn't so much that Miller was despicable as just that, I mean, I came out the other end with no impressions at all, you know?
Right.
So for whatever reason, like, my subjective response, like, as a person with a flow of impressions and ideas, my subjective response has been that Wolf registered to me as being an accurate representation of that in a way that Miller did not. But I mean, ultimately, that's, I don't know if that's something that you can pursue beyond just kind of saying, well, you know, my head feels like this or my head feels like this.
Right.
I mean, it's, I don't know if you and I, Patrick, have different brains in such a manner that my brain feels like Virginia Woolf and your brain feels like Henry Miller. Or if it's just a question of how a particular thing hit us, what it is. I mean, but either way, it's inevitably there, however much you might claim to be trying to represent the human mind and its granularity, you are inevitably going from one form into a very different form, I think.
Hans, you said earlier that... To the Lighthouse, I believe you said To the Lighthouse is not a book that you would have young writers emulate. And that kind of is one entry point to this question that I have about the style of this novel and its place in the canon and whether this is the emergence of a style, maybe the emergence of a style that, you know, maybe this is a bridge that, you know, has to exist for us to get to things like... I have not read Henry Miller, so Tropic of Capricorn. I was meaning that as a joke. Did I combine the two titles?
No, one's Tropic of Cancer, one's Tropic of Capricorn, one is...
Oh, Cancer of Capricorn, whatever. there we go, that's the last one.
And some others. He actually wrote a shit ton.
What is this something? Did this novel lay groundwork for work that came after it that does successfully learn from and emulate it? Is it a sort of a far point, and like a reference point that, you know, we don't really venture to anymore, but, you know, kind of teaches us other ways of writing about the interior mind? Is it something that really, you know, is sort of like celebrated and known because of how singular it is? I guess, like, what is the relationship between this novel and how we try to write today?
Minimal, I think. I mean, I think if Virginia Woolf, boy, and I'm, you guys may have different impressions than me, and I don't want to put my foot in my mouth, but I mean, Virginia Woolf is somebody who wrote a lot about gender. And I think her experimentalism endures to a great extent, I think, because she also wrote about gender. I mean, I think her, to the extent that she has a place in the canon, I assume that it's more so because she was kind of absorbed into feminist criticism, more so than because she wrote a novel where we get really, really granular with how people think about asking for a second helping of soup. I mean, I could be wrong about that, but when I hear people talk about being influenced by Woolf or being affected by Woolf, it's much more things like A Room of One's Own than it is. I mean, To the Lighthouse has some aspects of gender critique, but I think not as much as you might expect given her reputation, at least that I was able to find. I mean, the thing about a novel like this is that, I mean, well, I guess the whole kind of Lily Briscoe being mad because somebody tells her women can't paint or write, like, obviously there's a gender critique there, right? But there's so much else going on that it doesn't necessarily seem to me like a main, even really a main focus of the work, other than in a couple places in Lily Briscoe's subjectivity. But I mean, I don't really have the impression that the use of stream of consciousness into The Lighthouse, I don't personally know if I see a lot of the, I don't know personally if I see a lot of traces of that in much of anything, really. And maybe I'm totally wrong about that. Maybe it's there and I'm not seeing it. But it feels to me more like kind of a, as enjoyable as it is, as interesting as it is, as much of an achievement as it is, ultimately like kind of an experimental, maybe dead end is too cruel, but not something where the, not something where there's been much long-term influence in people's line-by-line prose writing.
I guess like the non-cruel way of saying it is that once something like this has been written, it doesn't have to be written again.
Sure. Yeah, definitely. Although, I mean, that hasn't stopped. that motivation hasn't, that reasoning hasn't stopped an awful lot of people from imitating other, you know, perfect works. I'm not saying this is perfect, but things that don't seem like they should be replicated are in fact often imitated. Anyway, sorry, Patrick, go ahead.
Well, the only other work that I can think of that that feels like it's doing something somewhat similar is Ulysses by you know, James Joyce. When was Ulysses written?
I want to say before this. My instinct is to say before this, but I am going to verify. So Ulysses was first published 1922, and To the Lighthouse, I want to say 1925, but that's, let me verify that. Okay. 27, okay.
So, yeah.
I mean, they were probably being written in parallel, but yeah.
I don't know if there are, like, obviously, I not being a scholar of like, this geographical, you know, this era and location of writers, I don't know if there would have been any overlap like between Joyce and Woolf, but I don't know, just the attempt, like Ulysses is an attempt to like just delve into the thoughts that of just everyday people and just like do it like to like lay it out there, right? Does that make sense?
I mean, it does a lot of other things, but that's an aspect of it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Like I don't want to say I'm like encapsulating the whole novel. I just mean that's one part of it.
It kind of starts with that, and then it filters it through a lot of other stylistic experimentations. But anyway, yeah, that's roughly accurate. Yeah,
right. So I don't know. I it seemed like there was some similarity there, but I don't. So I don't know. Like it seems like I think you're probably right, Hans, that like Woolf is famous for A Room of One's Own and like some of her other nonfiction work, and then because of that we also paid attention to The Lighthouse. So I do think like she's at least part of a tradition that overlaps with Ulysses at least somewhat, and now you cannot do this. No, I would say that no, you this is like obviously people do this like just because, but I would say that just typically this is not what you would do now because it's already been done. So it's more like the Truman Capote book we read in Cold Blood, where it is the style is important for its time, but now the style is not that since it's already been done, it's not that important to do again. Is what I guess I would say.
I guess it's sad for me to think that like Virginia Woolf, like, because I think my opinion is that this probably gels with the two of you. This book is kind of a one of one in that, you know, I haven't read Ulysses. It's one of the biggest holes that I have in my, you know, knowledge of literature is I've never read Ulysses, or Portrait of the Artist's Young Man. So
Hans thinks Joyce is great, but he sucks. He's horrible.
Oh no, Dubliners is incredible. Like Dubliners is a work of obviously goddamn genius.
Read Ulysses.
I should at some point, but when I was, you know, going through this, through To the Lighthouse, I thought, gosh, I don't know that I've ever read a voice like this, like ever. Mm. Like, and it's not really a character's voice, but there is a kind of an intuitive motion of that kind of carries us between the different characters in a scene that is so unique, I think, to this novel and so pleasurable, at least for me, that it is sort of something that I noted that like I wondered if this was something that had originated a style, or if maybe it got assimilated into a more successful style at some point, or how it was still influencing, if influencing writers at all, because I really find the experience of this novel very stunning, and it's and it really is just a very impressive feat to not anchor yourself and to just sort of and not anchor yourself to individual characters and not really have those characters be themselves consistent reference points. There's something just kind of like, you know, 4D chess about it that is like very, very impressive to experience. Ever since I first read this book, 4 years, I have thought back on the relationship between Mr. Ramsay and Mrs. Ramsay, and specifically Mr. Ramsay's reliance upon Mrs. Ramsay that is very, I think, just like, I don't know, it really kind of haunted me, this very egotistical, self-assured male, this very, you know, and Hans, you just got done saying that there are, that gender doesn't play a super big role in this book. And it is much bigger than that. But their relationship really does seem to explore this kind of parasitism between them that is, you know, not what is the term? That it's not, it is symbiotic. It isn't simply like a one-sided, you know, one of them, it isn't just Mr. Ramsay that's getting things out of this relationship. And Mrs. Ramsay does occasionally wander, it seems, through genuine devotion and adoration of her husband. But I've always just like thought that like Wolf captured something in Mr. Ramsay's like sudden kind of decline and need for Mrs. Ramsay's affirmation, and the way in which James, their son, sees it and is conscious of it too. And I just have this, you know, this paragraph here Mrs. Ramsay, who had been sitting loosely folding her son in her arm, braced herself and, half turning, seemed to raise herself with an effort and at once to pour erect into the air a rain of energy, a column of spray, looking at the same time animated and alive, as if all her energies were being fused into force, burning and illuminating quietly, though she sat, taking up her stocking again, and into this delicious fecundity, this fountain and spray of life, the fatal sterility of the male plunged itself like a beak of brass barren and bare. He wanted sympathy. And there's just something like incredible about this like relationship and this, not necessarily moment, because it kind of comes up multiple times, but this tension between the two of them that expresses itself with Mr. Ramsay's need for her affirmation and Mrs. Ramsay's kind of vacillation between apathy and resentment and also just open love. And it was, I don't know, I've always thought about this as something that just like pops for me with a lot of power. And I wonder if anything else, you know, if you guys felt similarly about anything else in this novel.
No.
Yeah, I don't know that I'd say I responded to anything with the level of passion that you responded to that paragraph, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wish I had, but I just can't admit that I did. I don't have anything similar to that.
Sorry.
All right. Well, you guys are disqualified from the rest of the podcast. And
you know, there were some cool passages like this. I'm going to be honest. This did not strike me like anywhere near like it did you, clearly. Like, there's some interesting stuff here, but
how dare you try to encapsulate my attitudes about this novel into one abstract feeling? My attitudes fluctuate wildly between vastly different feelings. Well, I only had one other question, which was about the kind of the jog that this novel has in the center, because we spend the most of the book very close to very, very in tight with these characters, and we've talked a lot about that, but there is part two, Time Passes. And it strikes me that, like, you know, if we think that the purpose of the book is this close attention, that, you know, like, if you were to sort of run with that, you could say that, you know, we don't really necessarily need part two. We could, you know, pretty simply get what has taken place in the intervening years from, you know, parts one and three sandwiched directly together and no part two in the middle. So part two is almost the thing that makes this a novel for me. You know, like if it was just part one and part three, like, would this be a novella? Would this be something else? You know, I think who was it, Hans? Someone else that we were forced to read who wrote about novels as big shaggy things. And really the only shaggy thing, the only thing that really complicates what this is part two, because the rest of it is kind of, you know, one continuous experience of what we've been talking about for the most of this podcast. So I'm curious, what do you guys think about part two? Like, is that something that if Virginia Woolf were to hand this to you, you'd say, like, you know, actually you could just sort of cut part two and then it's, you know, cheaper printing costs. More people will read it because it's a little bit shorter. People don't have the attention span that they used to. Like, what would you say to Virginia Woolf about part two, and how did you feel about it?
I would say, all right, Virginia, here's what we're going to do. We're going to cut out parts one and three and then expand part two.
I knew you'd feel this way.
No. I mean, that I liked part two. Like, I thought it added some cool, like it was nice juxtaposition. So, like, we stick very closely to people's minds in parts one and three. But in part two, we zoom out and, like, one of the Ramsay kids is killed in World War I. neat, you know, kind of a neat juxtaposition. I liked it. I thought it worked.
I found it profoundly haunting and evocative, and I can't really say why. I don't know that I can really kind of pin down what it is that works about it, but yeah, it has always stuck with me in a very deep way, and I have always found it moving. You had asked earlier about the influence that Wolf has on contemporary authors, if any, or the influence that the kind of stylistic experimentation of this work has on contemporary authors. And I don't think anybody would be well advised to try to write a whole novel in this style. But, you know, we had a writing teacher who would say sometimes that in a longer piece of fiction, sometimes it's interesting to give yourself kind of a confined space to go nuts, right? Like you rope off a particular part of it and you say, okay, I'm going to let myself go off the rails in this patch. And you kind of try to forget about the rules or basically, you know, imitate an author you would never think to imitate at a book's length, right? And I can imagine somebody saying, okay, for this sequence, I'm going to try a To the Lighthouse sort of thing. And I say that partly because we worked with somebody in grad school who actually told me that she was kind of emulating part two for a work that she was doing. She was doing a collection of novellas and was interested in trying to kind of emulate some of the techniques of part two as a way of representing the passage of time between some different parts of that collection. Now, that work, to my knowledge, was never finished and, you know, never came out, but it seems like something that you could borrow and probably has been borrowed by people that, you know, disguised it well enough that we don't recognize it as such. It's something you could borrow in a way that you wouldn't necessarily want to apply wholesale, but which you could kind of splash in this corner or that for some good effect.
Well, excellent. I think, do we have any closing thoughts on To the Lighthouse? Patrick, maybe we were talking about things that your work might need. Maybe it needs part two, a little bit of part two injected into it. You know, make your character more relatable and put a little spot in there where we get to see lots of time go by in a sort of poetic, evocative style.
I don't know what my potential publisher guy would say about, you know, adding like a part two time passes esque section to the novel. I don't know. You know, given that he wants me to make the main character more likable, he probably doesn't want me to add like some poetic shit to it. Probably not.
Probably there's like nothing more horrifying for a publisher to hear.
Right. Like,
then, yeah, like, I actually think this needs a little bit of To the Lighthouse.
Yeah. I'm just starting to add like a part to the middle of my novel, which is poetic and like many years pass. And yeah, it's like so Virginia Woolf.
Oh man, I want to go put a little bit more Virginia Woolf in this.
He would not be into that, I don't think.
So, Patrick, what are we doing next time?
Isn't it Hans's turn?
No, he did Lost. Well, I think we got kind of confused. We did Lost Memory of Skin.
That was my choice.
Oh, that was your choice. Oh, I keep on thinking of Hans, because I think I associate Russell Banks with Hans. So
yeah,
it is Hans's
me
turn.
Me too. Like Hans is the one who told me to read Russell Banks.
Yep.
Yeah. So it's definitely.
So Hans, your turn. What are we listening to now, or talking about next time?
So we're going to be talking about The Unbearable Lightness of Being.
Oh,
really? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, never. Yeah, yeah. And I actually, you guys did tell me it was okay to do this. You may have forgotten that you told me it was okay. But Patrick, I recently posted the episode on Robert Aichman.
Right.
And there's a section in that I, in retrospect, maybe could have edited out, but there's a section where you comment that you do not wish to see wrinkly breasts. And a couple of our listeners have contacted me to let me know that they also don't want you to look at their breasts, so fuck you.
What?
And in penance for that, I... that's somewhat of a, I'm somewhat,
you're making shit up.
I'm somewhat cartoonizing a more textured response. But yeah, so I actually have asked a female friend of mine to come on the pod as a guest and give us a little bit of perspective. She and I had been talking about Unbearable Lightness, and, you know, she had some interesting thoughts about it from a female perspective that I thought would be an, kind of an intriguing complement to the analysis of that work. So that is okay. My plan for next episode.
Cool. That Unbearable Lightness has always been on my to read list ever since John Fletcher told me I should back in the day. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, that's another one that we had to read for the fiction comps that I read it pretty late in the whole kind of comp cycle, and I, you know, failed to really internalize it like I should have because I was just kind of at a point of exhaustion. So I'll be interested in going back to it for sure.
Cool.
Well, you heard it here, folks. The trio will grow to a, how do you say, four?
Foursome.
A quadro?
Yes.
Foursome. Threesome goes to foursome.
Yeah.
What's trio to trio? It's trio and then foursome?
Trio to quadro?
Quadro.
Quadro. Quadrio.
Quadrio.
Quattro the dog.
Quattro. Trio will become a quadrio. And for our next recording. And thank you very much for listening to this episode, and we'll catch you guys later.
All right.